Today is Wednesday, March 29th, Zion Nisan. This Shabbat is Shabbat HaGadol. I apologize, I usually pride myself on relating to the Parsha at all times, but this is just on Shabbat HaGadol, so I wanted to relate it to the Haggadah in some way. And so in the Haggadah, it takes this pasuk, that these psukim that we're going to see in, that we see in Devarim, which you see as Parshat Ki Tavo, the famous Bikurim instance, and it says, you all read in English, you shall call out and say before the Lord, your God, and this should sound familiar to in Hebrew, Arami Oved Avi, an Aramean sought to destroy my forefather, and we went down to Egypt and sojourned there with a small number of people, and there he became a great, mighty, and numerous nations. And the Egyptians treated us cruelly. I'm just going to read the Hebrew because we're going to see it quoted later. Vayareu otanu hamitzrim. So you see the word ra, vayareu. The Egyptians treated us cruelly and afflicted us, and they imposed hard labor upon us. And then, so we cried out to the Lord, God of our forefathers, and the Lord heard our voice and saw our affliction, our toil, and our oppression. This is, if your Seder is anything like my Seders, growing up or even now, where you go around and you take turns reading, this is in that very long passage of Magid, where you're taking different verses from the Torah and expounding on them and how they relate to the Exodus from Egypt. So quoting from the Rambams, in the Rambam Mishneh Torah in Hilchot Chametz U'Matzah, he actually includes the full text of the Haggadah, which is very close to ours. So he interprets the word Ve'et Amalenu, which here is translated as our toil. Elu Habanim, this refers to the sons. Kamo Shenamar, as it said, Kol HaBen HaYelud HaYaora Tashlichuhu, all of the sons who are born, you should throw them into the Nile River. And every daughter you can allow to live. Here's a nice picture of the paro and the midwives. Okay, so now we're going to talk about the midwives who refused paro's order, which then led to all the boys being thrown into the Nile River. I like to call them the first practitioners of civil disobedience. And they really were. And you have probably learned the more traditional notion that the midwives, the Gemara says the midwives were either a daughter and a mother or a mother and a daughter-in-law. So the most common understanding is that they were Yocheved and Miriam, and I think when I taught last year on Parshat Shemot about Yocheved, maybe we talked about her as a midwife and with Miriam. Yocheved's daughter-in-law was Elisheva, married to Aaron, and that would be the mother and daughter-in-law model. So today, we are going to focus on the idea that maybe they weren't Jewish, they weren't Yocheved and Miriam, they weren't Yocheved and Elisheva, rather they were Egyptian women who were disobeying the command of their king. So let's read very carefully as we begin. Vayomer Melech Mitzrayim lemiyaldot ha'ivriyot. So right away, we have a translation issue. So you'll see it says, now the king spoke to the Hebrew midwives. One was named Shifra and one was named Puah. So how do we translate Milyaldot Ha'ivriyot? So you can translate it perfectly well, Hebrew midwives, but the grammatical Hebrew concept of smichut, which is best translated as a contraction when you compare it to English grammar, that takes two words that are dependent on one another, like the children of Israel, Banim Shel Yisrael, and contracts it into Bnei Yisrael. And there's different rules in terms of which letters change or don't change, or vowels, depending on if it's masculine singular, masculine plural. As you see in Bnei Yisrael, the final mem drops off and it becomes Bnei from Banim, versus feminine singular and feminine plural. In feminine plural, it doesn't change. So just as it could be translated as Hebrew midwives, in which case we understand it as Yocheved and Miriam, it can also be translated as the midwives of the Hebrews. So you see how that completely transformed our concept of who these women are. Ivriot is no longer an adjective on what type of midwives they were, that they were Hebrew midwives. It turns into a noun in and of itself. We have two nouns, the midwives of the Hebrews. And these are both legitimate translations of these two words together. There's no difference. So that is what we're going to focus on today. So I want to do a careful reading, and I want to point out to you ways in which things you might not have thought about could actually argue for the fact that they were Egyptian women. So first of all, we're going to see this in the Emet Liakov. If you look at the names Shifra and Pua, you'll see that they both, that the Pei, Resh, Ayin, Hey. What does that spell? Paro. So maybe these aren't names. We'll see it in the Emet Liakov. I won't give it away. Okay. Vayomer v'adchen et ha'ivriot. While you are delivering the Hebrew women, or iten et al ha'avnaim, and you see them on the stones. This is some kind of birthing stool or something. Im ben hu v'hamiten. If it's a boy, kill him. Oto, sorry. V'im bat hi v'chaya. And if it's a daughter, let her live. She may live. V'tirena ha'meyodot et ha'lokim. But the midwives feared God. So it's an interesting question. If they were Jewish midwives, would that be superfluous to tell us that they feared God? Of course they feared God. But it's actually interesting information if they're Egyptian, that they feared God. And we're going to talk a little bit about the concept of God within Egyptian society as well. So they feared God. They didn't do what the king of Egypt said. V'techayana et hayaladim. And they enabled all the children to live. So the king called to the midwives. And he said to them, why did you do this thing and you let them live? It seems like he's saying two different things. Why did you do this thing? And not only that, you enabled them to live. Et hayaladim, sorry, the boys. But Tamar na hameyaldot el Paro, the midwife said to Paro, "Ki lo kanashim hamitzriot ha'ivriot." These women, the Hebrew women, are not like the Egyptian women. Ki chayotena, and this can be translated in two ways. This word chayot, you'll see over here, it says they are skilled as midwives. So you, most of you probably know the word chayot as wild beasts. So Rashi gives both explanations. So the skilled as midwives actually has legitimacy, because if you look when you're in shul on Shabbos and you're using the Chumash and you see the word miyaldot, midwives, if you look at the Aramaic translation, Targum Onkelos, you'll see that the Aramaic for midwives is chiyuta. So it sounds a lot like chayot, chiyuta. So ki chayotena, because they are midwives themselves. Or because they're wild animals and they don't need anybody to help them give birth, just like animals in the wild. The term tavo alehem, before we even get to them, the term tavo alehem hamiyaldot ve'aladu, before the hamiyaladet, I have to focus. Before the midwife has arrived at them, they have given birth. Okay, now this is very interesting. Vayitav Elokim lamiyaldot. Hashem benefited the midwives. Vayarev ha'am vayatzmu ma'od. And the nation grew dramatically, very strong. So, first of all, this is one verse. God benefited, did well to the midwives, and the nation grew very large. So is the nation growing large a benefit to the midwives? If so, how so? Or what else could it mean that God did well to the midwives? We'll explore. Vayiki yar'u hamiyaldot et alokim. And it was that since or when the midwives feared God, Vaya'as lahem beitim, that he made for them houses. So first of all, we have the issue we had before with when we did Parsha B'Shalach of the hem, masculine, plural, ending. So did he really do something for the midwives, or did he do something to the greater population? And we also have the issue that there's no capital or lowercase letters in the Hebrew language. You see, our translation capitalizes it about God, that God made houses for them. And Rashi explains, what are the houses? For Yocheved, it's the house of the Kehuna in Leviah, because she was the mother of Aaron, who became, and Moshe, who were the Kohen and Levi. And for Miriam, who married Kalev, who comes from the tribe of Yehuda, it's the Malucha, the kingship, that David was a direct descendant of her. So if they're not Jewish and they're Egyptian, we have to redefine what it means that he made for them houses. And then, finally, Vayitzav Paro l'chol amo lemor, and Paro commanded his entire nation, saying, Kol haben hayilud hayora tashlichuhu, every son that is born, toss him into the Nile River. V'chol habat techayun, but you can let the daughters live. So we have another question of omission here. What happened to Paro's response to the midwives so blatantly ignoring his command? Any other society or situation when somebody so blatantly ignores the king's command, it's off with their heads. And here, maybe he made them houses. It's just very confusing. There's no reaction. So if you take the lowercase h for and he made houses for them, it could be Paro making some type of houses for him. So otherwise, there's no reaction from Paro to these subjects breaking his command, and it's really weird because he's not a nice man, Paro. So here I included for you the traditional explanation of who they were, just in case you didn't know what it was. That Shifra is Yocheved because she would improve, Mishaperet based on that name, and Pua is Miriam because she would cry out and spoke and coo to the newborn, like the Pasuk Kiel Leda F'a from Yeshayahu. And then Vayitav, this is about the priesthood and the kingship that I already explained. Okay, Emet Liakov, then as another, he also agrees that they were Yocheved and Miriam, but he says that Shifra and Pua were their Egyptian names. So he says, Shekol HaShemot HaMitzrim, all of the Egyptian names, Hayu Kruvim L'Shem Paro. They were very close to the name Paro. V'lechein keregel yesh ben ezet ziruf otiyot shel pei aleph, ayin, pei, ayin, and resh. So they all have some kind of letters from Paro's name, a pei or an ayin or a resh in their name. Ha'otiyot ha'ikariot shel shmo shel Paro. These are the main letters of Paro. The hey isn't such an important letter. Ve'elu hayu hashmot ha'mitriot shel Yocheved v'Miriam. And these were Yocheved and Miriam's Egyptian names. So why did Yocheved, and then he goes on to say, so why did Chazal, why did our rabbis think that these midwives, Shifra and Pua, were Yocheved and Miriam? Because we see when Moshe goes up to the mountain, he leaves Aaron and Hur in charge. And we know that Hur is Miriam's son. And how did he rise to such importance? It must be because his mother was so important and she was one of the midwives. So that's how he gets to that and have that in English. Okay, now I want to take a step backwards to show how it could be that any Egyptians could worship Elohim and what's going on here. So the first place we're going to look is when Avram says Sarah's his sister when he goes to Egypt. And then Paro finds out, indeed, she's not his sister, she's his wife. And so he summons Avram and says, what is this that you've done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister? So that I took her to myself for a wife. And now here is your wife, take her and go. And Paro commanded men on his behalf, and they escorted him and his wife and all that was his. So we're going to contrast that to the next time Avram says Sarah is his sister, and that's when he goes down to Gerar and has to contend with Avimelech. So Avimelech finds out in a dream that Sarah is Avram's wife and that Avram is this great prophet and he needs to give her back. And we have a very similar response. Avimelech summoned Avram and said to him, what have you done to us? And what have I sinned against you that you have brought upon me and upon my kingdom a great sin? Deeds that are not done, you have done to me. And Avimelech said to Avram, what did you see that you did this thing? And Avram said, for I said, surely there is no fear of God, rak in yirat Elohim, in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. So I just want to note that he didn't express this concern in Egypt that there was lack of fear of God. So it might not be so convincing, but hopefully you'll be convinced with the other sources that he wasn't worried about lack of fear of God in Egypt. That I'm not suggesting that Egyptians were monotheists by any means. What I'm suggesting, though, is that the Egyptians were very inclusive as to who could be part of their pantheon of God. And that Elohim was maybe known to them. And there were people who maybe worshipped Elohim. unlike in Grar with Avimelech, where Avram thought that there was no notion of Elohim, and that was what feared him. Just an interesting little aside here. And they will kill me because of my wife. So at this time in the history of the world, there's still a conscientiousness about the flood. And this is according to the Midrash. And the flood was brought about because of inappropriate sexual relations. So people were very careful about their relationships. However, they weren't so careful about murder, which means that if a man came by with a beautiful woman and said she was his wife, they would never take her if she was married to somebody, because that would be inappropriate, but they would kill the husband to make her a free single woman so that they could kill her. And contrast that to our day and age today, where adultery seems to run rampant, but we don't go around murdering people. I don't know which is better. Maybe, I suppose our day and age is better, but I don't know. Okay, so that's that. Next, the next time we see Elohim mentioned in the context of Egypt is when Yosef is the second in command and has not revealed himself to his brothers as they come to get food. And you see, Joseph said to them, "This is just what I have spoken to you, saying, you are spies. With this you shall be tested. By Paro's life you shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you and let him fetch your brother, and you will be imprisoned so that your words will be tested whether truth is with you. And if not, as Paro lives, you are spies." And he put them in prison for 3 days. On the third day, Yosef said to them, "Do this and live. I fear God. Ha'eta Elohim ani yare." And they don't bat an eye, and they still have no clue that he's their brother, which leads me to believe that it wasn't unusual for Egyptians to proclaim a belief in Elohim. And then the final one is after the brothers return with Binyamin. So they still don't know Yosef is the brother. "Now the men were frightened because they had been brought into Joseph's house, and they said, on account of the money that came back in our sacks," because of course he returned all the money on their way back and they couldn't return it, "at first we are brought to roll upon us and to fall upon us and to take us as slaves and our donkeys as well. So they drew near the man who was over Joseph's house, and they spoke to him at the entrance of the house. And they said, 'Please, my lord, we came down at first to purchase food. And it came to pass when we came to the lodging place that we opened our sacks, and behold, each man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight, and we returned it in our hands. And we brought down other money in our hands to purchase food. We do not know who put our money into our sacks.' And he said," and this is even more explicit, "'Peace to you, fear not. Elokechem veloke avichem, your God and the God of your father, gave you a treasure in your sacks. Your money came to me.' And then he brought Shimon, who had been held by Yosef since then, out to them." So we see references from the mouths of Egyptians, or Yosef pretending to be an Egyptian, of fear of God. And it's not so unusual. Rabbi Menachem Liebtag interprets this as just being a sign of being a good person. But I think it's something more than that. I think that it's the inclusivity of Egyptian society in terms of gods, and that there was a familiarity with Elohim, and it didn't shock the brothers to hear this spoken about. Okay, so now let's get into some proof texts that Shifra and Pua were Egyptian women. So this is Otsar HaMidrashim, which is a collection that was actually from the 20th century, but from very ancient Midrashim. And it gives a list of 23 kosher women that were in Israel, and it lists them all. I left it because I like these lists. But then it says, "Ve'od yesh nashim chasidot giorot." There were pious converts who were kosher from the goyim. So that is to say, it's assuming that Shifra and Pua were converts, that they were not Yocheved and Miriam, who were not converted. They were born Jewish. And these are them, and you'll probably recognize most of the names: Osnat, Tzipora, Shifra, Pua, Bat Paro, Rachav, Rut, and Ya'el. And the proof text of this is, "B'mi'odot Pua v'Shifra, Namar," it says about them, "V'tirana ha'mi'odot et Elohim," that they feared God. So this Midrash is using that line as a proof that they converted, which is interesting. Okay, then the earliest text, I think, that we have that they might not have been Jewish is Rav Chaim Paltiel. You see, he's from the 13th century in Germany. And he says, "V'shem achat Shifra v'shem ashniya Pua, matzati v'shem Rabbi Yochanan, sheshifra v'pua mitzriot hayu." So I heard in the name of this other rabbi that they were Egyptian. Bitzchila, in the beginning, v'nit gairu, and that they converted. Dim lokin, because if this were not the case, hechtivahu laharoget ha'yudim. How could Paro, and this is another question we didn't ask before, but we should have, how could Paro have commanded Jews to kill Jewish baby boys? V'gam hechodu ledvarav, and how could they have accepted his words? V'halo amar b'chol yavor v'al ha'yarog, because we know that this is one of the three mitzvot, that it's better to be killed than to sin on them. And they are inappropriate sexual relations, idolatry, and murder. So if Paro's telling them to murder, it's better that they should be killed than to acquiesce to his command, if they were indeed Jewish. And those are the three things. Avodah Zarah, Gilui Areyot, Shvichut Damim. L'chach kati v'tirana me'odot. Therefore, it says the midwives feared. Even though they had no reason to fear God in the beginning, because if that's not the case, that they converted, they grew to fear God, why would it include it? And what would this fear have been? Okay, so now the Abarbanel. Abarbanel lived in 15th century Spain, and he was the finance minister to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. And they actually offered him a deal to sign on as his, to stay on as their finance minister rather than be exiled with the Spanish Inquisition. But he chose to be exiled. He ended up in Portugal for a little while, where he also rose to power until the Inquisition moved there. And then he settled in Italy. And he wrote a commentary on, I think, almost the entire Tanakh. And it's very long. And so we're going to go through it a little bit quickly. So he says, "V'lo hayu ivriot." They were not Hebrews. Ki ech yivtach libo b'nashim ha'ivriot she'amitu v'ladehem. Because how could Paro have trusted his heart with Hebrew women that they would kill their babies? Aval hayu mitriot me'aldot et ha'ivriot. Rather, they were Egyptian, and they were the midwives for the Hebrews. Ratzon lomar, that is to say, ozrot otan l'ladet. They would help them give birth. Like we read in the Pasuk, when you're helping the Hebrew woman to give birth. Okay, so let's read some of this in English to get through it quickly. Why would he allow the female babies to live? Paro chose to kill the males and leave the females, since the females could be given over to the Egyptian men, and they would be drawn after them. And the Hebrew males were born with their nature and rooted in their attributes, all the more so that there would be complete suspicion on the males, and that they would increase and wage war in the land and overpower them. Not so with the females, as they are not warlike, and this is the reason for the command. And behold, it is impossible to say that there were only two midwives. Okay? It also doesn't make sense. We all know the Midrash, that the Jewish women were having six babies at a time. By the time they left Egypt, there were 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 50, which means that there were well over a million Jewish B'nai Israel, children of Israel at the time. So how could there only be two midwives serving the entire Israelite population? And do not say that they were the officers of all the midwives, like other commentators have said. Some people say these were just the heads of the midwives, that they would then send out other midwives. For it would be fitting that the verse would refer to them as officers of the midwives, because then we would have seen the Hebrew word sar, sar hamayaldot, the officer. Like we saw Sar HaMashkim and Sar Ofim, the two men who had dreams that Joseph interpreted. Sar HaTabachim, that's what Potiphar is referred to, officer of the executioners. Also, what use would it be for Paro to arrange this matter with the officers? For if they would not command all those who serve under them, and Paro did not give a command to command those who serve under them. Meaning there's nothing in the dialogue to suggest that Paro was giving this over to these two midwives to then give over to other midwives. And in fact, it seems that he was trying to keep it secret. Rather, the matter was such that it was a custom in Egypt that they would come as two midwives to stand with each woman that was birthing. One would be busy with delivering the baby and improving it, and she was therefore called Shifra. So that's really interesting. We have the same names with the same etymology given of the names, but this is for Egyptian midwives, since she improved the infant. The second was busy strengthening the mother and helping her with things and voices and prayers, and therefore she was called Puah in the language of Yeshayahu, like a travailing woman will I cry. So again, Abarbanel even uses the same pasuk as Rashi does from the Midrash, but for a totally different explanation. It says that Paro spoke to the midwives of the Hebrews, That is to say, all of them, for it does not say to two midwives. Rather, since there were many midwives, he commanded this, and they were all divided into these two jobs. And that is what it means, that one job was Shifra and one was Puah. So what's the scenario? Paro gathered all of the midwives together that served the Jewish community, the Hebrew community, and of all the midwives, some of them were in the role of Shifra, that they improved the women and the babies, and some of them were in the role of Puah, that they cooed to the babies and calmed them down. So all of the Shifra and Puahs of Egypt came, were gathered by Paro, and he gave this pronouncement to all of them to kill the baby boys and let the girls live, which then means that they would all fear God, which is also interesting that all the midwives did. Okay. And they were not Hebrews, for how would Paro trust his heart with Hebrew midwives that they would kill their infants? Rather, they were Egyptian midwives for the Hebrews. That is to say, they helped them deliver, as it says in the verse, when you were delivering the Hebrew women. And behold, these midwives, if they were Egyptian, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt commanded them until he rebuked them, saying, why did you do this thing and let the babies live? That is to say, the verse is not redundant, meaning, first of all, do this thing, and second of all, let the babies live. Rather, it is saying, why did you do this thing, that you did not kill the babies like he commanded them? And therefore, they said in a hidden way, why did you do this thing? And they said more, and you enlivened the babies. So not just did you not kill the babies, but you helped them live. The matter is that it was not enough that they did not kill them, but they also put effort into their existence and their success and their nourishment when the babies came out of the womb in such a way that they enlivened the babies, the opposite of what they were commanded to do. The midwives answered in apology when they said that they were not like Egyptian women because they were like animals, chayot. That is to say, in the matter of taking care of their babies, the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women who do not know what is suitable for the babies and rely on the midwives. The Hebrew women, in contrast, are chayot, which is from the language of living person, very active. That is to say, they are women of alacrity who strive in the matter of their children and enliven them. It is also possible to explain that they were chayot in the sense that they could give birth without midwives like wild animals in the field. And since they themselves give birth like beasts of the field, like animals of the forest, they do not call the midwife as they do not need one. And further, why do you bring guilt upon us for not killing the babies? What can we do about this when they have already delivered before we arrive? Okay, and this I don't have the English for. It's all my own translation, so I apologize if it wasn't clear. And now what does it mean he did good for them? Vayirav ha'am, and the nation increased. It's in this very thing that the nation grew and got humongous, that God did a goodness for the midwives. And also to the nation. So the Abarvanel is explaining that these two things are related, God doing good for the midwives and the nation expanding, because the fathers of these new babies were so grateful to these midwives that they didn't kill their babies and they didn't obey the command, that they paid them double or quadruple. So it was good for the midwives. They made a lot more money. Okay? And that's the goodness that God did for them. That in which he placed in their heart that they wouldn't murder them, murder clean blood, innocent blood. And this then turned into a bonus for the nation, because of this, because God placed this fear into the midwives, the nation grew mighty. And then this is what I love, the second explanation. So that was the first explanation Abarbanel gives for how he did good by the midwives. The second one, B'Efshar L'Faresh V'Yitav Elokim L'Miyaldot, and God did good for the midwives, B'Hashkachato, in his Hashkacha, so this is divine providence. Im He'otan Mitzriot Rashaniot, if they were wicked Egyptian women, Hital L'Vavan L'Heitiv, God leaned their heart to be good. Bizah, in this, Ukiila hatova asher asubaza me'alokim haita nisva, bizah inyan v'yitav. And it's as if the goodness that they did was from God who turned it around this way. And that's what it means that he did good for them. That is to say, she'as'an nashim tovot v'chasidot v'libutan, that he, God, made them good and pious women in their heart. God completely turned their hearts around had they in fact been evil Egyptian women. And that's what it means, God made them do good. Let's actually look at the pasuk so you can see how that works in it. So, Vayitev Elokim Lamiyodot. Hashem, so God benefited the midwives is how we said it, but it could be God caused the midwives good, to be good. Okay? It's just, I think that's so awesome. This idea that God put it in their hearts to be good, even if their first instinct would have been to obey his Paro command. And this is the same type of reasoning that our rabbis use when they say, Vayir'u otanu hamitzrim, and that was actually, sorry to hurt your eyes and go back and forth, but here you see from our psukim that the Haggadah is expounding on, Vayare'u, I pronounced it wrong, sorry, otanu hamitzrim, the Egyptians, it says, treated us cruelly here. Okay, just like we translated Vayitev as benefiting. So here they translate as treat us cruelly. But it could be the Egyptians eviled us. They made us evil. Okay, so let's see what the Abarvanel says about that. So the rabbis expounded on this, that the Egyptians made us evil. When was that? Shenemar hava nitchachmalo. When Paro said, let's get wise about these people in the very beginning of Shemot, the first chapter, and he says, let's get wise, and that's when they start the whole process of enslaving the Jews. Sheperishu, so the explanation of let's get wise with them, vayir'u otanu, they made us evil. Asumi menu ra'im, they made us become bad people. They made us into, as if we were bad people and sinners, v'chashdu otanu, and they suspected us, ki'ilu hayinu anashim rasha'im mordim baratzam, as if we were wicked people and rebelling against their land. And we see this repeating itself with many strangers in many different societies, unfortunately including our own, where people that we don't know so well or understand, we have suspicions of them based on what society does with them. So that's what happened to the Jews in Egypt. Paro had this master plan and cast suspicion over the Jewish people and made them bad. The same logic and reasoning as God making the midwives good. So now he's going to explain, according to this reasoning, what does it mean that he made them houses? So when he made them houses, we can explain that from another pasuk, that it's a hint, that he gave them riches and honor. That he gave each of these midwives that disobeyed Paro's orders a house and riches and sons and daughters, v'hem batim le'im kotov, and these are houses that are filled with good. U'mayisher amar katuv v'aslam batim l'shon zachar, and now he's commenting on the fact that it says lahem batim in the masculine, v'lo amar v'as lahen b'lashon nekeva, yesh lefaresh v'as lahem batim al Yisrael. So we can explain that maybe he actually made the houses for Israel, because from the reason that the midwives feared God, and they didn't kill the children, the nation increased. And that's what it meant. He made for them, for Bnei Israel, houses, that the sons and daughters would increase. And that, of course, is the essence of what a house is. It's all the things that are in the house. But you can also explain that, and he made them houses. This is the capital H versus the lowercase, that it doesn't refer to God. It shouldn't be a capital H. And it's not included in all the other good things that God did for them above. But rather, it's connected to what's written after that. After it says he made them houses, what's written? That's when Paro gives the command, right after it says he made them houses, to send all of the baby boys into the Nile River. So what does it mean? So I'll just explain it outside. It means that he made these special houses for the midwives, that everyone knew that that's where they were, so they couldn't make any excuses. That when somebody knocked to say a woman was giving birth, if they saw them tearing and taking their time so that the baby would already be born, then that would be reported back to Paro. So they had no control and nothing to hide under it as midwives with that excuse that they had. Okay, I think we're gonna skip the Malbim. He says, similar to the Abarbanel, that they weren't Jewish. He has some different explanations though. And here he quotes the Abarbanel even, that he made special houses where the midwives sat permanently in order that anytime someone would need a midwife, they would be forced to call them from this house. Appointees of the king also sat there, and they knew who was giving birth, and the midwives could not hide anything because they could not leave the house without permission or without informing where they were going. Okay, so that answers a lot of our questions as to how we can go about saying that the midwives were Egyptian women and the idea that they feared God and what was going on. One thing it didn't answer for us, and that's Paro's response. Maybe Paro made them special houses, but still, to make special houses for people who are blatantly ignoring the king's command, it doesn't seem like much of a punishment. So why didn't he say off with their heads? So I happen to be reading this book. I think the PBS program called The Midwife is based on this book, The Midwife, A Memoir of Birth, Joy, and Hard Times, put out in 2009. What?
Yeah, it is based on that.
Okay, so it's based on it. So I've never seen the show, but I read the book. It was a really beautiful, lovely book.
Yeah, you've never seen the show?
I know, I need to.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
I second that.
Okay, I will watch it.
Great.
You know, four of my five boys were born at home with midwives. And my first was also born with midwives in Israel.
They even have a couple of episodes that have Jewish themes.
Oh, cool. Okay, I'm definitely watching it. Okay, so I'm reading this book, and I come to this passage, and suddenly it's all clear to me, on a much deeper level, Paro's response or lack thereof to the midwives. So she says, she is called out to a birth in the middle of the night, 2 a.m, and she gets on her bicycle, and she goes to the birth. And she's living in what's called the docks. That's her assigned area where she's the midwife. And the people who live on the docks are the people who are fit for being dock people, meaning the ships would land, that's not the right word, whatever it is, at the port. And these people lived right near there so that they would be available to unload. So these are tough muscle men who are not the most gentle people. And there's lots of violence in this particular neighborhood. And she is the midwife. And she gets a call, it doesn't matter when or where, she goes off to help the woman give birth. So that's the context. I cycle on, intent on getting to my patient. A couple of policemen wave and call out their greetings. The human contact raises my spirits no end. Nurses and policemen always have a rapport, especially in the East End. It's interesting, I reflect, that they always go around in pairs for mutual protections. You never see a policeman alone. Yet we nurses and midwives are always alone, on foot or bicycle. We would never be touched. So deep is the respect, even reverence, of the roughest, toughest doctor for the district midwives that we can go anywhere alone, day or night, without fear. And I'd like to think that that includes, so deep is the respect, even reverence, of the toughest Paro, that they can get away with anything they want without risking their lives. They had a certain privilege. And with that privilege, I want to bring us to the words of Rav Joseph Soloveitchik, the Rav, in his famous book, Fate and Destiny, otherwise known as Kol Dodi Dofek, that he wrote in the 1950s after the Holocaust in the State of Israel. It's a beautiful book. I happen to be teaching it right now in my Tikva class at Kohela Yeshiva alongside To Kill a Mockingbird, where we're talking about fate and destiny. So I'm rereading it, and these words really struck me. So in the beginning of this book, Rav Soloveitchik explains the difference between fate and destiny. And he talks about the eye of fate versus the eye of destiny. So the eye of fate, when bad things happen, this is all about when bad things happen to good people, it's the Odyssey. The eye of fate asks why. And there is no answer to the why. So they get paralyzed in that state of why. The eye of destiny asks, what can I do to make it better? How can I improve? And that's the difference between fate and destiny. And then he also includes in this section, not only when bad things happen, but when good things happen. And what do we do with the bestowal of good, with the chesed that God gives to us? So here's what we're going to read. The bestowing of good is always conditional and temporary. When God bestows wealth, property, influence, and honor, the recipient must know how to employ them, how to turn these precious gifts into fruitful creative powers, how to include others in his happiness and greatness, and how to render loving kindness with the divine kindnesses that emanate and issue forth to him from a never-ending font. If an abundance of good does not bring man to absolute subordination to the Holy One, then he is guilty of a fundamental sin, resulting in the severe distress that in turn reminds him of his obligation to the Creator of the universe for the gift of his kindness. In short, man must solve not the question of the causal or teleological reason for suffering with all its speculative complexity, it's the why, but rather the question of its curative role in all its halachic simplicity by turning fate to destiny and elevating himself from object to subject, from thing to man. So I'd like to suggest that the midwives, in the privileged status of who they were as Egyptian midwives in Egyptian society, turned themselves into subjects from objects. They recognized the amount of chesed bestowed on them by Elohim that they feared, and they used that sense of privilege in the way that only they as midwives could to fix, to repair, to improve upon the situation. And in that, they entered themselves into destiny instead of fate. And they were recorded in the Holy Torah for us to remember them for eternity and to be grateful to them, whether they were Jewish or Egyptian. They recognized their standing and their privilege and their ability to enter the world of destiny from the world of fate in their civil disobedience in not obeying Paro's command. So may we all, over Passover, enter into our own worlds of destiny and be people, not objects, and not live a life simply of fate, but try to find ways how we can improve the world in the ways with the chesed that Hashem has given to us. Thank you. Amen.